So now we're going to have a panel on big data and privacy law, classification, segmentation, and fairness. And our moderator and first speaker will be Deidre K. Mulligan, who is an assistant professor at the UC Berkeley School of Information, as well as a director at the BCLT. She was previously the director of the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic and a clinical professor of law at the UC Berkeley Law School. Before coming to UC Berkeley, she was staff counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington. She is currently a member of the California Officer of Privacy Protections Advisory Council and a co- Well, it exists to the extent that it's on your biography here. Okay. And a co-chair of Microsoft's Trustworthy Computing Academic Advisory Board. Professor Mulligan received her JD from Georgetown University, and I'll turn everyone over to her capable hands.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm pretty sure we're all getting a little tired, so we're going to try to keep this pretty lively. And I think that it will be helped both by the issues and the fabulous group of panelists that I have up here. So I'm going to introduce them really briefly. We have Drew Liebert, is one of the California legislator's most senior staff attorneys, having worked over 25 years in both houses of the state legislature. He's been the chief counsel of the Assembly Judiciary Committee for over 16 years, where he and his staff counsel review and advise state legislators about virtually all areas of the state's civil justice system, including many bills involving the technology and innovation sector. He's a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of UC Berkeley. A recipient of a master's in public policy from the Claremont Graduate School, a Coro Foundation fellow in public affairs, and a 1984 JD graduate of UC Berkeley School of Law. And I'm going to, if that's okay, cut our bios just a little bit short. Sitting next to him, I have Susan Lyon Hinsey, who is a solo practicing privacy attorney. She counsels clients from small startups in major online advertising, analytics, and mobile companies on a wide range of U.S. and international data protection issues. She formerly served as in-house privacy counsel with Microsoft. Thank you. And next to Susan, we have Jim DeGraw, who's a corporate partner in Ropes & Gray's Technology Group with a background in computer science. He regularly leads projects for clients where technology data or other IP assets are the key drivers. He's a certified privacy professional, and his practice includes advising clients on the collection, handling, and protection of data by their organizations. He received his JD cum laude from NYU School of Law and his BS from Columbia. I'm realizing I missed telling you that Susan received her degree from the University of Texas School of Law. And last but not least, I have Nikki Ozer, who's the Technology and Civil Liberties Policy Director at the ACLU of Northern California and works on the intersection of new technology, privacy, and speech. She graduated magna cum laude from Amherst College and also studied civil rights at the University of Cape Town, South Africa, and earned her JD with a certificate in law and technology from the UC Berkeley School of Law. And she also worked at MOFO for a bit after. So I just wanted to start by clarifying one thing. I am really, really grateful to people acknowledging that I had some small role to play in the data breach laws, but I want to assure you, and I probably don't need to assure the people in this room, anybody who knows, like, the path from an idea to a law is arduous, long, and leaves you full of, like, bruises and wounds and stuff. Then Assembly Member Joe Simidian, along with Senator Peace, really made that into a law. I, you know, contributed a tiny idea. And so I just want to clarify, because that was a real heroic effort on their part. Okay, so we are going to be talking about big data and privacy, which you all know is a really hot topic. We have several activities happening. And we already heard some of the implications of the EU regulation as they try to deal with profiling issues in addition to kind of the way in which we traditionally think about personally identifiable or identified information. We're going to have a pretty wide-ranging conversation and flag some of the ways that the big data environment, we're going to define big data broadly and widely, I guess, as, you know, very large sets of data that people don't really look at. Every once in a while, somebody will say, well, I need to look at the data. And I'm like, you don't really look at big data. Like, machines do that. People don't really look at it all that often. And analytics, and in particularly data that is not just human-generated, but is generated by our devices, our cars, our smartphones, our thermostats, the growing range of everyday objects that we have in our hands, in our wallets, and or sitting in at all times, that are generating and collecting and sharing information about us, or about the things that we're doing, even if it's not explicitly about us, in a routinely wired environment. And we're seeing, as these data are emerging, lots of new issues and new voices. And we're going to try to flag a few of them. One has been a very big issue of concern and question about how well do some of the traditional issues around notice and consent map on in this environment, right? So in an environment where we have lots of data being generated passively, collection, consent, and context seem to become really important and really, really burdened and complicated. Second, we're beginning to understand that there are surprising implications for our privacy in other people's data, right? So I can know much about you by who you hang out with. It turns out your mom was right, right, when she said be careful who you associate with. We also know that data can be incredibly predictive, even when we're trying not to reveal things, that we can know what, if we know what you did last night, we might be able to predict what you're going to do tomorrow. And so we're losing some sense of our ability to limit what other people know about us because of the predictive capacity, again, often rooted in other people's data, not just our own. Some of the tilting playing field, we historically have thought first of governments and then of kind of, you know, a growing set of corporations, but still some limited set of corporations having the wherewithal, the resources, and the technical capacity to amass information and to use this sort of analytics to use it fruitfully. We're seeing that change, right? And so we now know that many, many small players are able to leverage big data and big data analytics that can influence the way in which we think about information asymmetries with respect to consumer transactions, not just high-stakes, high-value transactions such as mortgages or loans in other contexts or employment, right? We see that data being used in a much broader set of areas. Moving on, private life. We traditionally rely on a bunch of different ways to segment our private and public life, and some of it is being really challenged as devices, such as our PDAs, mobile devices, fluidly move from one environment to another, both exposing corporate interest to perhaps some of our own personal predilections about what apps we use, and also exposing our information about what we're doing at home, in bringing it into the other environment. So some challenges there. And then finally, some growing questions about inscrutable algorithms. How do we think about issues of fairness? How do we know why decisions are being made when we're talking about big data analytics, which often defy analysis? So new voices, 2 weeks ago, a group of civil rights organizations released civil rights principles for the era of big data, right? And they're talking about stopping high-tech profiling and ensuring fairness in automated decisions, preserving constitutional rights. These are not completely new issues to these conversations, but these are constituents who are joining this conversation who have very specific experiences, right? That they're bringing to the table and saying our interests are in part due to the bleeding of the public and private sector, the kind of porous nature of that boundary, which people are feeling very pushed up against, squeezed by, but also that they want to be part of this conversation about the use of information both to benefit as well as some of the potential downsides for their communities. Certainly, they're also concerned about traditional privacy issues, about individual control and protecting people from inaccurate data. But, you know, some of these new issues, profiling, fairness, are really important to keep an eye on. So we have some new privacy considerations, and it's not just a single, right? So we have the right to control personal information. We have concerns over autonomous decision-making, so the way in which information about us and other people, people who you might think are like us, are being used to shape our environment and our experience. People might not be just concerned about whether you have their data. It's whether or not you're using other people's data to shape their experience. Right to control access to the physical self. People are getting much more concerned about the Fitbit data, the pieces of information that are not born digital so much as their expressions of actual physical attributes. And how do they think about their connection to that sort of information? And again, place-based understandings of privacy as the protection that the home or even the car, the number of people who sing at the top of their lungs, right? It's right up there with the shower, all of a sudden become more porous. Some difficult challenges for privacy to face alone, right? The fact that your data might tell you something about me, my secrets. We've understood this in the context of genetic information, where we have protections not only about the collection of my information, but even about the information that my mother might have decided to send to 23andMe, about right being used in context of making decisions about me. But it turns out that we are very social creatures, and our information is not just useful in individual silos, but aggregated, it can provide lots of information about specific individuals that they might not yet have revealed. Bits of data to mosaics, right? The Jones case really brought some of the mosaic issues home, although they didn't adopt that theory so much. This idea that people are disclosing little bits of data, even by choice, right, with lots of control, user-generated content, etc., but they might not appreciate the way in which that data adds up to something bigger. The fairness issues. Some of these are really interesting from a privacy perspective, in that when we think about intentional discrimination, privacy solutions seem like they might be quite helpful, right? If you don't have information about my gender or my race, my nationality, it might be difficult to use that to make a decision. However, as we know from policing discrimination or trying to avoid it, if we don't have data about race and ethnicity and gender, it's really hard to engage in policing to enforce anti-discrimination laws. So there's some tension between some of the privacy and fairness issues. We also see that it's not just about discrimination concerns about protected classes, that people are beginning to be concerned about unequal bargaining power more broadly, about undue influence, right, a concept that we think about in law, and about ideas about unfairness, right, with which the FTC and the state AGs are very comfortable thinking about. And from the civil rights community, we hear about issues of cumulative disadvantage, right? So the fact that the algorithms, data, may actually be re-encoding experiences in a way that limit the opportunities that certain segments of the population are afforded, because it keeps them in their little bubble. With respect to algorithms specifically, we are hearing questions about bias, right? Algorithms are used to classify and to segment. Classifications can't be unbiased unless you really want them to do nothing, right? In order to be helpful, they have to have some purpose, and that purpose is expressed as a bias. It's an organizing system. But some questions about transparency and accountability. What sorts of biases are encoded in algorithms, and who is encoding them, and how do we ascertain their impact or their intent? Transparency, which is often put out as a panacea, if you talk to somebody who is involved in machine learning or designs algorithms, they're like, looking at the code isn't really going to get you very far. So how do we think about accountability? And I'm going to open it up with that whole set of questions to my panelists. And I wanted to see if we could lead off with Drew and get some thoughts from the state of California.
Well, first of all, as you mentioned the state of California, I'm reminded of President Ronald Reagan's famous admonition that the scariest words in the English language are, "Hi, I'm from the government and I'm here to help." So I take that with some humility. I'm delighted to be here. I feel much more like a student than a teacher today. It's great to be able to participate and to hear all of the great information provided. I would say that these issues are a perfect setup for the difficulty and challenges facing policymakers in dealing with these privacy issues. I was talking with someone during the break and realized that when we talk about who our clients are, I consider mine to be consumers. And I actually think, as you all work in the trenches, that it's probably pretty easy to forget where consumers really do fall in this. And my own theory about this, Deidre, is that consumers are typically pretty ignorant about what's actually going on in the internet. So, for example, I say we have developed through the free internet process the facade of consent, that there really is no such thing as real consent for most people, because the way the internet's developed is you get a little pop-up and it says, here's a 10,000-word privacy policy. If you agree, then let's have the service, and everybody clicks, I accept, and we move forward. And so I think these issues in regards to, as we call it, big data, from a public policy standpoint, for me, they always direct me to the biggest gorilla in the room that we tend not to often talk about, and that is these folks we call data brokers. And I think that's where you're going to see increasing attention now, both at the state level and the federal level. By the way, Hank, my colleague who said to you at the last panel, pay attention to California, I think you really should, because I think we all recognize that there hasn't been a lot of agreement and progress happening at the federal level, other than the FTC. And so that you should assume that we're going to see a lot of percolation right now, particularly post-NSA, at the state level, and particularly in California, trying to grapple with these types of privacy issues. And I think that the aggregation issue, in terms of the ways in which it can potentially injure all of us, is one that the legislature will focus on greatly.
So, Susan and Jim, I'm wondering if you have ideas about consent, context in the era of big data. How are you talking to your clients? What are you advising them? What do you think of some of the activities that have been going on at NTIA around trying to create codes of conduct that might be more contextually relevant?
So, Drew mentions that, you know, his clients are consumers, and my clients are not consumers, but I am a consumer. And the best piece of advice I got as a privacy professional is to put yourself in the shoes of the consumer. And using that approach, I think it's has been very helpful, because a lot of what we do is predicting where the law is going to go. And there's a lot of uncertainty in this area. We don't know where the law is going to go, but one of the things I do for my clients is try and help them understand, you know, what are the trends. And in this area, you know, uses of data, having more control over the data is becoming more and more and increasingly important. Also helping them understand that, you know, look, there are efforts underway, NTIA being one of them, a lot of industry guidelines and the like. And all of these things are not technically the law right now, but they are the basis of what will be the laws in the future, whether California enacts them or whether there's a federal law, which is at this point, as Drew mentioned, is probably highly unlikely. But it also indicates, you know, how will the FTC perhaps enforce this under an unfairness action. And so thinking about, you know, how data is being used, thinking about the notices that you give individuals around the use of that data. But I think more importantly, a lot of my clients are e-commerce clients, as well as folks on the sort of more analytics advertising side of things, helping them understand, you know, what do you need to do contractually when you're dealing with people who are, you know, taking your data, to make sure that they're not using it in ways that they don't expect. And you know, you can notice and choice is great, but if you don't even know in your own organization how your data is being used, that can be very challenging. Concepts of anonymization and aggregation seem like those are things that can just protect the data from these sort of harms happening, but anonymization just simply means the data is in a form that is currently not identifying somebody. That doesn't mean that somebody can't re-identify that data down the road. And so there's a lot of things that these laws are designed to protect, but they're not necessarily addressing the issue in a way that I think you know, needs to be addressed, frankly.
No, I think that's right. I think when we think of our clients, we recognize, because they tell us, and we have that conversation with them about privacy, is that your ultimate customer is a consumer. right? So whether it's financial services sector, whether it's life sciences, whether it's an e-commerce vendor, at the end of the day, they're dealing with consumers, and the brand image is very, very important when you think about data. So collection and notice at that point of entry, it's part of the toolkit today, right? And I think it's generally recognized, and we heard it today, that you know, if you're going through a country where people just check a lot of boxes, people check a lot of boxes, and they move on. But consumers are increasingly asking, what are you doing with the data? And how are you treating my data? And when we advise clients, we say you need to be thinking longer term, because the regulatory trend is coming up. Begin to think about what tools that you have in place to look at it. Transparency is a question that I'd love to come back to and talk about what that really means, because we look at it and say, you have the import, how are you collecting it? What are the rules of the road that you put on your folks who are collecting data? You have the use, and then what uses are you actually putting it towards? Right, the processing that goes on in between defines whether or not your use is actually legal at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And if you're not thinking about it from the beginning and the end point, the middle can have lots of problems.
So, Nikki, working at the ACLU, you have the lovely job of focusing on both the public and the private uses of information. And given that we've already had some conversation about the implications of the Snowden revelations for the dialogue between the U.S. and the EU, and with clear ramifications for the private sector, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the ACLU and your perspective on the connection between big data in the private sector and big data in the public sector, and some of the directions that you'd like to see things take.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was so interesting at the end of the last panel that Chris Wolf talked about how sort of industry has now sort of issued this plea for there not to be a conflation between consumer privacy and government surveillance. And I have to admit that sort of warmed my heart a little bit, because I've been at the ACLU for 9 years trying to talk about the data ecosystem and the connection between data collected at the front end and government access to data at the back end when there aren't sort of strong privacy protections in place. And I think what's happened with the Snowden revelations is that it's really sort of blown the top off of this issue, that it's really been a black box for a lot of years, as Drew sort of mentioned at the beginning, that a lot of consumers just have not understood the issues of data collection and things that are marketed as free. They assume sort of there's not a price to it and haven't understand the issues of what data can be collected, how long it can be retained, how it can be used, how it can be combined in different ways, either currently or in the future, to have potential impacts on privacy, on personal security, on financial issues. And I think that when we look at sort of the issues of big data, we're going to see a lot of attention and issues both on the front end and on the back end. As some of the other panelists talked about, there's a real sort of confluence of factors at this moment, which is putting so much attention on these issues. Obviously, the NSA revelations, but also the data breaches, the recent revelations about data brokers and the kind of really sensitive information that they're collecting and sharing. And so I think we've long had this black box about people not really understanding what's happening. And now that the curtain's been swept away a little bit, you're starting to see the public react and say, that's not what I bargained for. I may have trusted a particular company, but I didn't realize that information was going to be sold to data brokers or shared with third-party apps or shared with up to 100, market trackers on that website, or the government being able to access that. And so I think it's a very interesting time that we now have both the companies and the NSA on the defensive saying we're misunderstood and saying that we need sort of that you don't really understand what's happening, where actually I think the public is for the first time starting to actually understand what may be happening and reacting and saying that isn't what I want to be happening in the future and we need to create change in this space.
So some of you might remember, I have written about it, but I actually wasn't there at the time, but when the Electronic Communications Privacy Act was passed in 1986, it was a confluence of factors that the Justice Department was making arguments that data that was being processed remotely, or that emails that were being hosted on a server for a company were not protected under the Fourth Amendment, that that data wasn't to be thought of as things that they continued to have a reasonable expectation of privacy over. And it was interesting because we saw an alignment. Jerry Berman, who's my former boss at the Center for Democracy and Technology, was at the ACLU at the time. And the ACLU, along with IBM and I believe AT&T, and you know, a real confluence of players from the public and private sector, came together to push for the Electronic Communications Privacy Act because industry was very, very concerned that without the same sort of protections that you had for first-class mail, for example, people would be reluctant to use and benefit from new technology, that you were not going to use your email if it meant that you were foregoing all of the privacy protections that protect individuals as well as businesses in that context. And it's interesting that there's certainly an inflection point, I think, here. Nikki was saying that some of the risks are kind of become more evident and I think more profound. There's already a group of industry and civil liberties organizations that have been pressing for updating the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, as many of you know, the Digital Due Process Coalition. And one could think of this as perhaps the necessary fuel to move that conversation along. However, given some of the roadblocks and deadlocks that we have in D.C., it seems unlikely that that good sense, which would provide some certainty and clarity to consumers that using these cool new services, right, that we all want to take advantage of, won't lead to easy government access to data. But given that it seems like that is not likely to happen in D.C. and anytime soon, despite the fact that many of us might think it would be logical and appropriate, what sorts of things do you think companies might do or might be thinking about doing, or would you advise them to do? Certainly the transparency report's been fabulous, right? Understanding which governments are asking for what sorts of information. But what else do you think we might see?
So on, you know, one of the things that I think e-commerce retailers and other online companies, I think generally don't think that they're engaging in a lot of the activities that are leading to some of the more sort of profound stories that we're hearing about, although some of them are. But when I'm advising clients, I don't tend to see people saying, I really want to target this disadvantaged minority, or I want to exclude this disadvantaged minority. I'm not hearing those sort of conversations going on, although I'm sure that they're happening. At the same time, some people are using that data, and that data is coming from somewhere. And one of the things that I think is happening is that companies are letting their data be, are unwittingly, just as consumers don't really know what's happening with their data, I don't think a lot of companies understand what's happening with their data and how it's being used. Believe it or not, I think there's this sort of idea and comfort around this idea, as I mentioned earlier, around anonymization and aggregation of data. A lot of people don't understand what aggregation means. One person thinks aggregation is just pooling a bunch of people's data together in one database. That's aggregating it. Other people feel that aggregating is really group-level statistical reporting. There's not a real common understanding. So when people are contracting with people who have access to data, they may be using this terminology but not really have a common understanding of what does that mean. The other thing is around anonymization. You could have a piece of language in a contract that says it's anonymized, but if you're not also making sure they're not using it for other purposes other than directly to provide you services and maybe specific improvements of their own service, they could be taking it and using it for other marketing purposes of their own or others and de-identifying or re-identifying that data with other people's data. And so, I think the appropriate approach is you look at what these data brokers are doing. Where are they getting this data? There's not a lot of transparency, as some of the GAO reports have revealed, around where that data is coming from. And I wonder if some of those data sources realize that they are the data sources and if that's not, you know, part of the problem. So I think there's, just as there's an interest in industry being, you know, having more transparency around, you know, what the government is doing with data, I think there are probably some in industry who would have some interest in knowing, well, who is using this data? Where are they getting this data from? And I think it would be very illuminating for a lot of people to shine some light on that.
So some of the issues in the data lifecycle that companies that may be generating data and sharing it for one purpose might not fully understand that the data can be repurposed for other uses.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there's only so many, we have a, you know, as the previous panel pointed out, there's a bit of a shortage of privacy professionals out there, and without, you know, more learning and teaching, which thankfully, you know, institutions like Bolt and others are starting to do now, there's a lack of knowledge and understanding around the implications of a lot of these issues that many lawyers still don't understand right now. I think there's still a huge learning curve, even in our profession, around what the real risks are.
I think one of the benefits, though, of the Snowden revelations has been actually it's shined a light on it. And we have heard in the last 6 months more and more clients saying to us, we don't want to be in that position. Right.
Yeah.
And therefore, we have clients who are thinking much more carefully about what data they are collecting, whether or not even, you know, this isn't security, but are you securing your communications from the get-go with strong encryption? When you're pulling in really sensitive information, at that point of collection, if you are, say, you know, pulling sensitive financial information that you want to pull some sort of profile on, overall, how much sensitive information are you stripping out of that immediately so you can't re-identify it or can't use it in a way that's identifiable, as opposed to the old practice, which would be create this massive database and then think about selecting fields from it, right? So you're seeing much more sensitivity in certain client segments because of these revelations to thinking about the data they're holding and what they're collecting, because they realize they will have, you know, whether it's the United States or in Europe, we actually have clients calling us up saying, why am I worried about the Patriot Act, right? And the answer is you're not, right? But this is the reason why you're hearing this as an issue in the Netherlands, right? And it's all these NSA revelations about what data is being collected or potentially collected by the government that's really beginning to get people to think more closely about the information they're pulling in.
At the same time, not everyone is getting government requests. You've got a lot of companies, you know, small, medium-sized companies, grocery stores, you know, maybe they'll get, you know, a few, but they're not getting, like, you know, typically, yeah, not getting, you know, the amount of sort of, you know, NSA requests that, you know, other larger companies are. And I think a lot of this data that, you know, that people are worried about from a discriminatory standpoint are coming from all these very, you know, disparate sources of data that are, you know, part of our, as consumers, everyday lives, that we, you know, are providing data to without, you know, realizing, of course, the implications. But I think even the companies that we're dealing with sometimes are not, you know, when I go to, you know, my local grocery store, you know, they may have, you know, a web beacon ad on their site or, you know, other types of tracking activity, and they probably don't have a real appreciation of what that data is really being used for. Same thing with, you know, a company that provides a rewards program. I think a lot of times these companies don't understand the full implication of what it is that they're allowing their consumers' data to be used for. And but, you know, they're not getting the, you know, they're not really that worried about the Snowden stuff. There are some companies who are, but, you know, I think there's a vast number of companies out there who aren't realizing. Although, you know, you've got, was it Office Max with their with the story about the father who receives an envelope addressed to the father of whose daughter died in a car crash, you know, addressed to him in that fashion. Those stories, I think, are starting to percolate some interest amongst companies around, well, what, you know, where is this data coming from that we're using, and then where's our data coming? And so I think as more and more of those scary stories come out, we'll have more companies interested. And, of course, the regulators are going to be interested in those stories as well. I think as we have more of those scary stories come out, you know, perhaps that there might be a big enough story, you know, like the Target breach, which is, I think, putting a little bit more air under the wings of the data breach, federal data breach laws. Perhaps, you know, a story like that could, you know, but, you know, I as a consumer, I'm a little worried that might be a little too late.
So that raised two issues. One, I do want to talk about data brokers, because clearly, I think I can say this in this room, we're all waiting with bated breath, right, for the FTC's report on data brokers. But I first just wanted to say that there's this disconnect, perhaps, that Jim and Susan were pointing out between large companies that do get data requests, that understand that they're kind of data hygiene practices, and really understanding what does it mean to de-identify data and what does it mean to do statistical reports, are perhaps in the wake of the Snowden revelations really looking hard at what they're doing, similar to the way people reacted when the data breach laws came on. It was like, I need to know where data is an asset. I need to actually take care of it, and I need to understand the risks that it poses. But we know that certainly for the startups that come out of the School of Information or from many of the startups that are happening in the Valley, they don't have the resources to invest in lawyers of any sort unless they're helping them figure out how to incorporate. And right. And so, Nikki, you did a really nice report a few years back, right, that was really aimed at trying to make privacy by design a little bit more accessible for other parts of the economy. And I'm wondering, are you getting more calls? Are you thinking about updating that? There have been efforts. The California AG's office as well has been very focused on trying to help application developers. The FTC has been focused on application developers, NTIA. Smaller folks get privacy, quote unquote, right. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up here in Palo Alto. I have a lot of friends who work in business incubators and are venture capitalists. And several years ago, sort of when privacy was starting to sort of ascend in importance, I was asked to come to speak to a lot of these startups who otherwise didn't have lawyers and realized there wasn't really a lot of good resources for them in terms of case studies and tips about why baking in privacy or free speech or security is sort of an important part of maintaining your bottom line or avoiding risk of lawsuits, of getting hauled in before Congress or having FTC investigations. And so we released this primer, which is available online as well, that's all just case studies and tips for companies to sort of really start thinking through these issues. And when we released it, it was sort of on the sort of cutting edge of these issues, and increasingly we've gotten a lot of attention and a lot of companies trying to sort of really think more about these issues. I just came back from South by Southwest last night, and I will tell you, if you wonder if this is sort of hot in the startup space, whether privacy and security is hot in the startup space or in the innovation world, privacy and security was selected as the digital trend of the year at South by Southwest. I was asked to accept this award for the digital trend of the year, which has previously gone to Pinterest. So it was sort of a shocking moment for me to stand on the red carpet with this little award about privacy and security being the trend of the year. But it has sort of really brings into perspective just sort of how much this has crossed the boundaries and how much, from the smallest startups to the multinational corporations, you know, Mark Zuckerberg yesterday did a blog post about, you know, confused and frustrated about the NSA. And so this has really become the mainstream issue on these spaces. And I think it's really essential because people are starting to realize, as we sort of talked about earlier in these panels, that it's, you know, as Snowden said on Monday in our live broadcast with him, that, you know, the NSA has lit the internet on fire, and it's up to the tech community and those folks whose business models and trust are based on the trust to consumers to be the firefighters to put out that fire and to make sure that trust is regained. And the only way to do that is to make sure that people feel comfortable that their privacy and security is protected. So we are, I think, at a really crucial moment. We are certainly hoping and working on many fronts in D.C. to try and move things through Congress on these issues. But the reason why I'm an ACLU lawyer who's based here in California is that there are some things we can move here in California and that we should move here in California because this is where the innovation lives. you know, that can influence what's happening in D.C. and influence what's happening around the country. So we've been working very diligently for several years on everything from issues of transparency to warrant for location and electronic information. We're working on many, many fronts. My friend Drew over there, many of them going through the committee he works with. But, you know, this change does not happen because it should. It happens because we push for it to happen, and it's going to require, like it did in 1986, a coalition and a powerful coalition of organizations and the tech community to push this change through, because right now the technology has advanced exponentially, and I don't have to tell anyone in this room that the privacy protections are, you know, stuck in the 80s. So we have a serious problem for consumer trust. We have a serious problem for innovation if that remains the situation for much longer.
So let's turn to talk about data brokers and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And one of the nice things about the Fair Credit Reporting Act is that it kind of turns our language to include not just privacy, but fairness, right? And it is a statute that both looks at collection of information, but also very, very squarely its use. And the FTC has been flexing its muscle a little bit in this area and looking at the definitions and saying, hey, some people who might not view themselves as credit reporting agencies or as people who are generating consumer reports, if you are targeting yourself into markets to be used for the purposes of making the sorts of employment or financial decisions that we think of in those markets, beware, right? And when we look at this concept of fairness and we're starting to think about information uses, I think the FCRA and the data brokers are in many ways kind of the canary in the coal mine, right? That as data begins to be leveraged in all sorts of decisions, we see the Wall Street Journal reporting about the fact that you and I get different offers for Staples at Staples, I believe, right? Or Office, but I don't remember. But all of a sudden, then consumers saying, hey, I understand if I'm going physically to a store, that might make sense, but if you're offering it to me online, why should my price be any different from your price? And is that because of data about me, or is it about where I live, or what are the things that are influencing your decisions about the sort of offers and treatments I get? And so this concept of fairness, I think, is really coming back to life. And it was very much at kind of the heart of some of our early privacy statutes, the FCRA particularly. But I wanted to open the conversation up about this concept of fairness and algorithms and decision-making and data and how it's being brought to bear on all these sorts of market transactions. So, Drew, why don't you start us off?
Okay, so I want to mention another quote that I love. By a guy named Eric Schmidt.
We don't know.
And he said, and you probably all know this quote, but I love it just to give you an insight. The internet is the first thing humanity has built. It doesn't understand. It's the largest experiment in anarchy we have ever had. And it's easy for us to forget what has happened in the last 20 years. And the reason I say that I'm going to get to data brokers in this, because from my standpoint these fascinating issues, you're all so lucky to work in them, is that, as Tom mentioned earlier in the day, talking about privacy has become really complicated for all of us. We don't really know what we expect anymore, necessarily, when it comes to privacy. I, for example, took the Axiom invitation. You might recall they invited all of us. How many of you went to Axiom to find out what your dossier is? You should. I went to Axiom, and if you're here, I don't mean to offend you. I went to Axiom, and I went through the process. The first thing they ask you to do is to give you your full Social Security number. And the reason they ask you that, they say, is in order to verify that it's really you. And, of course, I was really nervous because everybody's told me over the years, you don't want to give anybody your Social Security number, although everybody's always asking for mine. And so I did that, and the limited information that they gave me was wrong. In fact, one of the things that it gave me that I thought was fascinating is it said that I basically have a very small income. Now, I do, relatively, but I was still just a little offended that they thought it was that small. And then I was put to the test. So they give you the option, when you all try to do this now, do you want to correct it? And I thought to myself, so is the act of correcting a good idea? And what will that impact be? I tell you that story because that's the kind of stuff I think we're all dealing with and ultimately all going to deal with. What if they make mistakes? I think it's one of the great ironies. You know, that there are reports now, you all know this, the fastest growing industry in the United States of America right now is the data broker industry. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. We have a whole new data broker company opening up in Sacramento. The irony of that is that they are the least transparent operation that we have in this country right now. I don't mean to speak on behalf of the FTC, but if you try to find out, as if you come from government, I can tell you from our level of what is happening with the data broker industry, you're not going to find out much of anything.
You have to be on the purchasing end,
I guess,
which many agencies are. So
I would just suggest to you that what's happening with the aggregation of data by private companies that can affect all of us has great, great potential for negative tipping points for consumers in the future. Do we have the ability as a consumer, number one, to realistically find out what they think we are? What's the dossier? And who's got them and how do they differ? All those kinds of questions. Second of all, if we can do that, do we have a reasonable ability to correct mistakes? And what are the impacts of doing so? And three, what kind of regulation really makes sense for all of us to make sure, and this is really critical to our conversation, that this information isn't misused? If you're lawyers like many of you are, you know that in the world of the internet space, it's extremely difficult, both in terms of causation and in terms of harm, to ever prove that you've been subjected to something that you can be compensated for in court. I know there are lots of class actions, but the reality is it's hard. And that matters to all of us as consumers. So I think the issues that are brought about by the data broker industry are going to increasingly capture the attention, not just of policymakers here in California and, of course, at the federal level, but I think they're going to capture all of our attention ultimately. And the question will be, will there be tipping points of scandals, of difficulties that will make consumers start to get really nervous? And I don't know the answer to that.
Jim?
I think FCRA actually is getting more and more attention, right? And one of the things that we keep on telling clients ourselves is you need to look at this statute, right? It's one of the few tools out there when you think about using data and putting data to use that has statutory damages associated with it, mm-hmm. and attorney fee shifting provisions and whatnot. It's a class action plaintiff's dream. Mm-hmm. And we actually look at it from the perspective of why haven't we seen more already? Right? And the FTC.
It is an interesting question.
It is, right? Yeah. Because you really think that it will come and you're going to have an expanded scope of people who are going to hit foot faults and move into being subject to, you know, FCRA, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, than haven't in the past. You know, traditional data brokers know it, they know it well, they deal with it. Your experience is not surprising, right?
Right, right.
It's the new folks who are falling into it because they're studying these new business models that are actually probably more of a concern than anything else. And, you know, when I think of FCRA, I think of the overall question, what do we do with data brokers and data collection? I think of an end-use kind of analysis. We have these laws on the books already that think about how you're using data, right? It might just be it's a smaller data set, right? But anti-discrimination laws, mm-hmm. antitrust laws, pricing laws, discrimination, you know, credit reporting, which, you know, FCRA is well aligned to the fair information principles. So we have these already. The question is, you know, will those tools be used in ways that people aren't expecting at the moment to really clamp down on the end use that's unfair as opposed to maybe just the processing that people are doing and thinking about it? And that's where the consumer expectation hits the road, I think, more than anything else.
And I think going back to what we were talking about before, I think transparency isn't the solution to these problems, but it certainly is a linchpin to be able to know something's happening and then be able to apply either existing laws or push for other change to happen. If we look at the NSA revelations, they were secret for a very long time, and we didn't have the information we needed to be in the courts. You know, now we have 30 bills moving through Congress on these issues. You know, Dianne Feinstein, case example, you know, she finds out something has happened in terms of the CIA, you know, getting into the computers of the Intelligence Committee. Once you know, you can then push for change to happen. And so, you know, I've been sort of a broken record on some of these issues of transparency, both for the companies. We've been pushing for transparency reports for years and years. We just filed shareholder proposals against AT&T and Verizon this year that pushed them to finally release their first set of transparency reports. And we've also been pushing for transparency on the consumer side. we have a law here in California called Shine the Light, which was passed several years ago, that allows California consumers to learn what information has been shared about them in the direct marketing context, which when it was written was defined as postal mail, email, or telephone calls. Well, we know in this day and age that information is now shared through online advertising, third-party apps, the data brokers, and that law doesn't apply to those contexts in sort of the modern digital world where information is shared. So, you know, while we co-sponsored a bill to update Shine the Light last year called Right to Know, which would give California consumers rights similar to what EU consumers currently have to know what information has been collected about them and been shared about them, whether it's data brokers or advertisers. As you can imagine, that bill was very well liked by industry. And it didn't move through, but the reason for us proposing that bill and for hopefully it will move through in the future is that when people know when something's happening, it both incentivizes the companies to do better about these issues and also gives people the information to push for that change in other ways. And without the transparency, we're sort of in a catch-22 where we can't show harm and we also can't mobilize the consumers to sort of understand why we need substantive laws. So it isn't a solution, but I've had lots of conversations over the years about how it can be a really essential part of moving in the right direction of solution, and I think the Snowden revelations are sort of a prime example of that, and the stories that have come out about Office Max and other things. So that's why I'm a broken record a little bit on these transparency issues, and I will continue to be, I'm sure, for several more years.
So transparency was, for those of you who have ever gone back and read the HEW report on automatic data processing and privacy issues, written in 1973 by lead author Willis Ware, who died earlier, well, towards the end of 2013, I guess. Key principle emerging from that was that there should be no secret record-keeping systems and a real commitment to transparency with individuals about what data was being collected. One of the things that's interesting is today we know that access to the data about us is probably not really sufficient for us to understand its implications for us, right? And part of what we're trying to pull apart here is that it fails in several ways. One, it's that your data isn't the only data that's being used to influence your experience, right? That we're leveraging data about lots of other people. And two, that your data is only one part of what gets fed into some algorithmic decision making. And it's not just the data, it's how the data is weighted and what sorts of learning algorithms are being used that are going to have implications for the outputs. And so when we think about transparency today, I think perhaps we need to update our concepts of transparency and also respect some of the limits of transparency. I don't know if any of you as lawyers are really good at reading code. I'm not so great at it, and many regulators aren't. And even if you are somebody who writes code, you would be told by any of them that if somebody wants to hide something in code, if they wrote it, it's relatively easy, right? And so even if we talk about saying, well, you have to disclose your code, or you have to open up your algorithms, or you have to use open source code, that is still suggesting that that level of transparency is going to help us ascertain the implications of big data and data analytics seems like a stretch. So what sorts of things should we be thinking about in addition to or in lieu of, or what's the next stage in thinking about transparency? We all think it's important, but
I mean, you raise an interesting challenge. Clients I work with, you know, often take pains to try and anonymize data, and they do that, and yet when, you know, access requests and the like come through, how do you sort of, you know, reconstruct that data to explain how the machines are using the data about a particular person when you've taken all these steps, you know, in part to help protect their privacy, to make them as anonymous as possible. And yet at the same time, machines sort of out of, you know, direct, you know, human control are with of course human input, are making decisions about individuals. And, you know, how do you you get the genie back in the bottle, or we can even look at the genie again when it's just from the technological standpoint, it can be very, very difficult. So I think that's one of the challenges that needs to be addressed. I'm not exactly sure how you would address that. You know, maybe anonymization has not been such a great idea after all when you're talking about transparency, because how can you have transparency if you can't, you know, re-identify that data that's being used about you that's out there and being used in some way? So that's it's a difficult challenge for a lot of my clients.
One flashpoint that we're seeing out there that's sort of nuanced but has a really large impact is sort of the coverage of the law. We see a lot of laws that cover personally identifiable information versus in California, you know, our constitutional right to privacy talks about personal information, and Jan talked about sort of personal data and sort of what the coverage of that is. And so you'll see this flashpoint in a lot of state laws and also federal laws. What are we covering? And so in the bills we work on, we cover personal information. And like in the update to Shine the Light, we included inferences about an individual in that definition so that somebody could actually find out what data a company had about them that was an inference about them. So I think, you know, those are sort of the nitty-gritty of some of these things when we're dealing in the law, but when you look at the definitions, the coverage of that definition and what we're actually dealing with can mean transparency or not transparency, depending on that. And you see sort of the advertising companies, and in this conversation with big data, you know, the ag companies went in to talk to Podesta at the White House yesterday, and they talked about how they don't collect personally identifiable information. Well, they don't define unique device IDs as personally identifiable, because it's not identifying Nicole Ozer. It's just identifying the phone Nicole Ozer carries around all the time. So those are some nuances where it's sort of somewhat intentionally misleading and can have a really big impact on the conversation and on the transparency that, and the impact of the laws and the issues.
So I'm going to give Drew a word, and then I want to open it up to the audience.
Well, I think actually conferences like this are great, and they reflect in some ways what's happening in communities across the country, partially because of the NSA issues. I can tell you in California, the Target data breach has caused lots of conversation amongst policymakers. For the very first time, they're starting to ask, so how does all this stuff work? So how did they get that stuff from the, what's a POS? And how did they do that? And where did this come from? And is it all 110 million people? So those are the kinds of initial conversations that are going on. But I think we need to have this kind of public conversation, because we're in this revolution, this remarkably fast bullet train of change, and that I don't think many of us actually have been able yet to quite figure out the way it used to be compared to now as to what are our fundamental notions of privacy. Do they even exist anymore? Many people say privacy is dead. Others suggest that we have just a completely different view. Some people say it's generational. I know my 21-year-old could give a darn about privacy, no matter what I tell her. And so these conversations that we're having at conferences like this, and I think they're happening increasingly amongst not just policymakers but across the country, I think are going to be really healthy, because I think we have to figure out what we think those notions really should be.
So I'd like to open it up. I hope there's some questions in the audience. Is that, yeah?
I was wondering if you could weigh in on why we haven't seen any investigative journalism with respect to the data brokers. I represent like startups and a lot of people in the publishing world, and obviously I'm bound by the attorney-client privilege and NDAs that my clients are bound by, but I do think there is a large disconnect between what's actually happening and what people think are happening, and I'm wondering why there isn't interest in the journalistic community.
I think there has been.
Follow me on Twitter.
Bing, Julia Angwin.
Yes. Julia Angwin's done a really good piece, and also ProPublica did a great piece on data brokers a few months ago that like laid out all this information about them. So if you're interested in those stories, I'll try and tweet it out with the hashtag.
60 Minutes just did a great piece. Yeah. I don't know how many of you saw that, but it's starting to percolate. No question about it.
And the Center for Investigative Reporting
supported in at conjunction. Robert O'Hara did a book several years ago now, maybe, I don't know how many years ago, that did quite a job looking at data brokers.
In fact, I guess...
No Place to Hide, I believe.
Yeah. The Wall Street Journal reporter, Julie, whose last name is...
Penguin.
Thank you. She gave a presentation at IAPP that was jaw-dropping about how she tried to become lost, basically.
Right.
And it was, as someone who practices in this area, I was blown away by how difficult it was to remove her identity. Mm. So, there is a lot of interesting stuff on that.
Yeah.
Right, the cost, right. It was extraordinary. So it's definitely worth taking a look at that, and there's lots of people looking at this issue from an investigative journalism's perspective.
But it's really, really tough, because this is a very, as Drew was saying, this is like the biggest, this is multi-billion dollar business, and they have a lot to lose. And so they're very secretive about what's happening. I mean, Congress tried to do an investigation about data brokers and pretty much wrote, that they could hardly find out anything, and these were members of Congress. So the FTC is working on something, so we're all looking forward to seeing that.
So we need more journalism, but clearly the journalists are on the beat.
Hey, Deirdre, it's Tom again.
Hi.
So great panel. Wanted to ask sort of maybe a more concrete question than has been identified so far, because there's been... I don't know, a fair amount of abstraction. So let's take something that we know to be a signal as on a specific dimension. So if you want to have a loan and you fill out an application, it turns out the ability to spell is actually a reasonably good predictor of whether you'll repay the loan. Okay? So is that something that the loan processor needs to disclose to the consumer? Because, of course, once that's disclosed, it ceases to be a useful signal. So how is it that we, how do you solve the signal versus noise problem when the disclosure of the use of the thing actually ceases to make it useful as the signal for what you're trying to measure?
So, I mean, we know whenever there are data points and heuristics used to make decisions that people who want a particular decision are going to try to figure out how to game it, or if you're thinking about a standardized test, learn how to succeed, right? And I think that people have different motivations for wanting to meet the measure of whatever the metric is, and some of them we might say, well, that's problematic, and others... It seems unfair, perhaps, if you're using certain things against people, right? But exactly, I think, where that line is, right? Some people might say, wow, you're going to use whether or not people spell right to make a decision about loans. Well, that seems like it's probably going to impact certain aspects of the population in ways that might be problematic, to the extent that it's re-encoding some biases about who has access to education, who, right? So,
but it doesn't cease to make it a good signal. So let's.
It doesn't. No.
But,
no.
So
and
let's,
sometimes.
But so just yes or no?
Yeah.
Like, should spelling? Should we be allowed to use spelling as a variable in deciding whether to extend a loan to someone?
I think it's a great question, and I would say, so Oscar Gandhi wrote maybe 15, 20 years ago now about some of the kind of troubling implications rational discrimination, right? And
no,
you're saying this is a rational use of data point.
Specifically in the context of the collection of information by the government, right? So
no, he wasn't.
Well, FIPS and the report that he, we're talking about the FIPS report, right?
No, Oscar Gandhi, no.
Okay.
He's a professor.
Okay, but so I suppose we're not going to get an answer to the question as to whether...
You are, but...
No, we
no,
are.
You are. Let me give it a shot, because I think it's great that Tom likes to have fun.
Me too.
I would first throw back to Tom. You're the one that said big data issues are tough, so remember that.
But I'm going to say, Tom, come on up.
But second of all, I would say... In the area of disparate impact, historically, we would then ask ourselves another question, right, Tom? And that is that a substitute potentially for discriminatory behavior? Because what we're really talking about, people whose language may be not English, it may be some other language, their first language. And so that type of disparate impact question could come in mind. But I would just say to you, those are precisely the kinds of complex issues that we all should be thinking about in the potential misuse of data.
I think that's actually right. We already have laws that take that approach. If you look at GINA, for example, we had a policy judgment that was made that we're not going to take genetic information and use it for certain purposes. That might actually play into, you know, a loan decision. So, you know, if we take that balance and we look at some of the uses that we're putting the data to and create that balance from a policy perspective, we may be able to legislate some of it, but we're not going to be able to legislate all of it.
And I would just say that I'm not trying to dodge your question. I'm saying these are exactly the sorts of questions that there are a lot of areas where we see great evidence using big data of correlations that are meaningful. But there's a question about, as a society, are they legal? Even if they're legal, are they ethical, right? Do, even if you were a business and you were free to use that as a signal, suggesting that maybe it doesn't fall out directly on lines that we would view as problematic, right, because they're, the impact affects protected classes, that we still might think that there are ethical implications, and perhaps that's not what we want to be doing.
I'm happy to make the hypothetical harder, right? So,
please.
So, for example, if you use race, which is an excluded variable, let's say it's more predictive, not less. Still, right? Let's imagine now if we exclude race from the calculation, that spelling ceases to be an interesting variable. But when we include it, it is. We more comfortable or less comfortable?
Same answer.
Right. And so we've now had three people weigh in on the question, and no one's been willing to say yes or no. So
No. Well, and I mean, I think one of the interesting questions becomes, like, if you're using that correlation because it's meaningful, you know that you get better results with your loan repayment, whatever it is, right, if you use this particular variable. And you actually haven't, this wouldn't happen in the loan context, but you actually don't know about race or gender or nationality or language proficiency, how would you avoid having that impact, right? And so there are some interesting tensions between what we might think was a good privacy solution and what we might need to do, either policing discrimination or avoiding things that, as a business, even if you're allowed to do some things, we know many businesses don't do them because they don't fit with their own values as a company. Right, and sometimes data is really, really important to helping companies make those sorts of judgments.
When you can just sort of modify that that example in the NSA context, so it's exactly the kind of arguments that we're getting, that, well, if we tell people what kind of surveillance we're doing, it ceases to be useful for what we're trying to achieve. And so here we are as a country sort of in the balance of discussing, well, what are the costs and what are the benefits? How much transparency do we still really need for a democratic process? And so there we sort of come back to the issues of big data on both the consumer side and the government side. There are connections between those two, and there are arguments that are percolating through both of those aspects.
So we're going to take one more question. You might get the last word.
Well, this isn't a question. I wanted to answer his question because I felt like someone should. So Ken Kumayama Skadden, I just wanted to say, you know, if you've ever used Lending Club or something else like that, you don't have a lot of information on the potential borrower. One of the few data points you have is whether they can spell, actually. And I play on that a little bit. And if they can't spell, like, basic things, that's one of the things I would certainly look at. So I would say, as an individual, yes. Is it right or wrong? I mean, yes, I think it's, from my perspective, as not a real lender, but like an individual who's trying to help people out, but, you know, I want to make a risk assessment, I think that, you know, it's legitimate as an individual to do that.
I guess we'll leave that as the last word. So we're all looking forward to the FTC data brokers report, and we'll see what they have to say. All right. Thank you so much.
Before you leave the room, I have a few announcements. I am Robert Parr, Executive Director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology, your host for this event. We're really pleased to see all of you here. I want to, first of all, I want to thank Professor Paul Schwartz, who conceived of this conference. Paul has been our leader and the inspiration for 3 years now, and it's growing, and we'll be back next year. We hope to see all of you. It's really great the way we see more and more people every year. We predicted that. The audio will be available on the BCLT website 3 weeks after the conference. Materials will be posted on the resources page for the conference. You can scan the QR code. You can go to the BCLT website just by searching for BCLT and recognizing that we're not the Burlington Community Land Trust or the Bangalore Center for Leather Technology, both of which should be lower, so search for us. For CLE credits, you do have to sign the thing out there with your state bar number. If there's ever an audit, that's what they look for, not the little piece of paper, but take that too. I want to thank our event sponsors, Alston and Bird, Ropes and Gray, and Hogan Lovells. I want to thank all of the moderators and speakers, and special thanks to the BCLT staff, who's worked really hard to put this together and have done a great job, as I'm sure you recognize. We have two events in April of interest. For those of you former IP lawyers who have seen the light, you might still be interested in copyrights. We're having a symposium on the next great Copyright Act, and we're not kidding. The 18th annual BCLT symposium with the Berkeley Technology Law Journal will be April 3rd and 4th at the Claremont Hotel in Berkeley. We'll have another privacy event April 9th at the Bancroft Hotel. We're having the 7th annual privacy lecture, also conceived and led by Professor Schwartz. This year it's entitled Privacy versus Government Surveillance, where network effects meet public choice, and obviously timely topic. So thanks again, and please now join us for our reception sponsored by Hogan Lovells right outside the room. Thank you very much.